Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor, superhero, and epidemiologist Mike Coulter. When I call Mike Coulter a superhero, it's not really because he's now starring as the unbreakable Luke Cage in his own Marvel series on Netflix. It's because of what it took him to get there. He got himself into grad school and then nearly got himself kicked right back out. That's before he decided to prove wrong the people who said he wouldn't make it. Very wrong. Then there were the years of being flat broke in Los Angeles, working minimum wage jobs while scrambling to auditions. And after finally getting his big break as a boxer in Million Dollar Baby, he had to fight a business that only wanted him to play athletes. But Mike's a guy that's not going to take a role unless it involves some intelligence, some risks, and the chance to show he can do more as an artist than we expect. In this episode, you'll hear about the most terrifying stage experience of his life, why he first wanted no part of Luke Cage, and the favorite role you never saw him in. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm great, man.
Thanks for coming and doing this.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you and I have something in common,
mm-hmm.
which is not that we're both in superhero franchises, but that that we both spent time in Los Angeles broke and hustling for jobs and relying on the Thomas Guide.
Oh, yeah. That's
yeah,
what you did.
Before I was working full-time as a photographer, which is how I started, I was doing just about anything to make rent. And I remember balancing the Thomas Guide on my lap as I drove and trying to find, you know, a production company that mm-hmm. I was trying to work at or whatever. And I read that you'd done the same thing in LA. I mean, mm-hmm. it's interesting to me. I know that you came from a very classical form of training and you have a master's degree in acting and you went to Rutgers and you know, really educated guy. And then you find yourself in Los Angeles broke.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. that speaks to some conviction that you're willing to go through that, right?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, I rushed out here when I first graduated from graduate school because I thought it was like, you know, it was this land of opportunity here. And I was like going to miss out if I didn't get out here soon enough. So I came out and my expectations would be that, you know, sure, I'd go out and struggle a bit. But my talent and my uniqueness, whatever that was, would somehow persevere, and I would eventually find my way. And it's easier said than done because when you're thinking about it, time is kind of a strange thing. If somebody told me it was going to take me 10, 15 years to get where I wanted to be, I probably actually would be okay. I kind of knew that. But actually doing it is something completely different. Because the day-to-day grind, the week-to-week, the ends meet of it all is really not something you're really prepared for. I was basically busting my hump, and I was going through the paper looking
at... And you had no money.
No money. So, you know, I had three or four jobs, you know, within a month. I mean...
And were you getting auditions?
It was so bad because you know what happens, you know, this is also, again, before, the internet was there, I mean, but emailing, at that point... People still weren't giving you appointments that way. I was going across the hill to my agent's office and picking them up via, you know, physically picking up the scripts because nobody was emailing these, you know, PDFs.
Right.
I had to go get the script, the hard copy, and the sides. And I'd have to, if he called me and it was like 6 o'clock in the evening, I'd have to go out there and get it and try to prepare that, you know, for the next day if possible. Meanwhile, I also had to go to the job the next day. So I literally was basically just trying to stay afloat. I didn't have a lot of like time to really focus on my craft. I was kind of like, I just got to pay the bills. I got to put some food on the table. I got to, you know, pay for groceries. That was it. I mean, it was tough. I did labor ready, which is something
that... What is that?
That's a job where you basically go and you show up and you give them your license, you give them your ID. They give you a job. It's first come, first serve. You give you a job. It's always minimum wage. And it is something that someone or any company needs you to do, and it's menial labor task. It's like maybe sweeping up, maybe cleaning up some construction sites. You may be just stocking shelves in a new store that's been completely disconstructed. It is really just it's so menial that you
like
can't
no
even...
Like no skill work.
No skill level whatsoever is required for it. I had a master's degree, so here I am, you know, thinking this is really beneath me. But I'm like, you know, I got to pay the bills. So for 2 weeks, I'm doing this job, and I'm getting up there. And the only people that are there with me are... ex-cons, essentially. Like guys
really?
Who are in halfway houses, who, you know, ex-drug addicts, you know, these are people just again, no skills, just come in.
And what licensed. made you go there? How did you end up there? Because that's it seems like, you know, there's restaurant work. There's...
Oh, but it's so competitive. So I'm an actor. I move out here, and everybody's got a restaurant job. And once you got a restaurant job, nobody's leaving that. That's gold. I mean, you're like literally every restaurant I went to, nobody was hiring. I was looking for every restaurant job I could think of. Till I finally broke through and got to the Cheesecake Factory.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Cheesecake Factory. Took a 2-week course, and I was one of the ones, I think, I want to
You graduated from Cheesecake College.
Cheesecake College. Got my all-white uniform. I put that on. And I was one of the first, I think, the one in Sherman Oaks Galleria.
So would there be stretches of time where you wouldn't have any auditions and you'd just be doing this work?
Yeah.
And the dream would seem a little further out there?
It did. It just got, you know, it was just such a, it was. It felt so distant because by the time I got my first job, you know, it was a job that didn't actually air. I mean, I got paid for it, but the scene I did got cut. It, you know, it was my introduction to the television business. Like, you know, hey, you get a couple little scenes, maybe they get cut if you're a co-star. You don't know how important it is to the story. So, so I was excited about getting the job, getting the paycheck, but then it was about 3 months before I got my next job or something like that. So it was basically, I was just kind of out here working. The auditions were there, but sometimes I couldn't make them. You know, I couldn't be there because I had to work. So it was a struggle between being out here doing what I wanted to do and just trying to make ends meet because I had a wife to take care of or my girlfriend at the time. And, you know, that was more important. So.
And did you ever sort of consider a plan B or did you always sort of believe that it was going to work?
No, you know what? I got to tell you, if it wasn't for her, I think I probably would have left the business several times over.
Really?
Yeah, because there was a real moment, I guess my first couple jobs, there were guest stars, and I thought, well, now I'm building momentum. Well, by that time, my wife had been out to L.A. with me for a year.
Right.
And she was working her doctorates and working her thesis, and it kind of was very difficult for her to finish her thesis because she was so far away from the university. So just by the time I started working, I'm like, well, you know, she said, I need to go back to New York. So going back to New York back then was a big deal because it wasn't a lot of work out there. I mean, this was like 2001, 2002. All the work was in L.A. Now that's all changed. You know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
But yeah, back then I think that
there was like a career
killer.
There
were killer. No TV shows in
no,
New York.
It was,
right?
It was Law and Order.
Right.
For me, it was essentially a career killer. I mean, her moving back there was kind of like saying, I moved out to L.A. for all this opportunity. I was just starting to kind of pop. And now I'm like... moving back to New York was a huge sacrifice because there was no reason to think that things were going to change.
Right.
So against my own instincts and my better judgment, I did it because, you know, because my wife needed it and I loved her. I wanted to kind of like support her the way she supported me. So I moved back and hit a skit again. I did a regional theater just when I first got out there just because I didn't want to be in New York. The weather was brutal. I mean, I'd been out in L.A. for a couple of years and I was like, this weather sucks, so let me just go find something to do. So I went out to Florida and did a little play out there and I did that. I came back and I'm like, well, I'm never doing that again because once I got back, nobody knew where I was. You know, regional theater's like, what kind of play? You know,
right.
It's a play, you know, unless it comes to Broadway or off-Broadway, nobody cares.
God, how confusing and how like... when you don't have a map or like it's just a mess.
You're treading
right?
water. At best, you're treading water.
Yeah.
At worst case, you're drowning. I mean, there was very little time up until probably the last, you know, several years where I felt like I was swimming forward. You know, I was just kind of, you know, treading water. And for me, treading water wasn't good enough. You know,
how did you square that with your belief in your actual ability to act?
I felt like sometimes that was also a part of, you know, paying your dues. And sometimes some actors don't pay their dues, you know, in a sense. They pay their dues in different ways. And sometimes they don't have to wait as long as you do. And so
right.
You have to always remember that your story and your journey is yours. And you can't get involved in someone else's journey. Someone else's journey is going to be completely different than yours. And remember, this is always, it's a race, but it's not against anyone else. It's your own race. You're running it by yourself. And it's a marathon. It's always a marathon. So you can run as fast as you want to, and you probably end up in the same place. But at no point does someone else's progress affect your own. It's completely, you have to put blinders on in this business because, you know, it's really difficult. You have friends sometimes who are really successful doing stuff, and they're really, and you're busting your hump in a restaurant. You're like working there for years, and you're trying to figure out, well, when is my turn? When am I going to get out of this, you know, this rut? And
isn't that human nature, though, to mm-hmm. to look at your peers and mm-hmm. and sort of go, well,
why not me?
Like, I'm following that path. Why isn't it? Like, did you have some times where you had to sit yourself down and say?
Yeah, and it's okay, because, you know, what happens is, you know, I think people don't want to admit to it, but jealousy is a natural instinct. It's a natural feeling. And I think you have to give it its space. And because what happens is you give it its space and it'll pass. But you have to give it its space. You have to give it the space and acknowledge it. Because without that, you suppress these emotions and they start to come out in different ways and they frustrate you and it also takes away the energy from your own art and your craft. When you walk into a room, I feel like you always have to have this zen quality.
It's like that catch 22 of going into an audition. You can't want it too much.
Can't want it too much. You can't walk in there and be desperate. Nobody wants a desperate person. Nobody wants to feel that desperation you walk in the room. They want to know that you belong there, and you got to know that you belong there.
So how do you learn that before you actually just have experience?
The failures are really what happens. You know, you have to have the failures. I think without the failures, you end up falling harder and farther later. Like if you don't have the failures prior to your successes, when you do fail, if you just have successes and then when you fail, you don't know how to pick yourself back up and get going again because it's just not, you're not used to it.
When you say failures, what are you thinking in your mind? Like
just close on jobs, just not quite there. Okay. Not, you know, always, you know, the other guy, always opportunities that you thought you should have had, but you didn't. And what I've learned is that, especially back then, is those opportunities probably weren't meant for you. And I've started, and that's something that changed, you know, for me. Somewhere, you know, before things started to click for me, I started looking at things and realizing that if I didn't get it, or if it wasn't, you know, meant for me, then it's probably better. And I can start to dissect how this thing wasn't working for me and how it wasn't meant for me. It's not about like getting the job. Sometimes the audition is the hard part. You got to be a good auditioner to work in this business. And the minute you stop wanting to audition and wanting to prove yourself, that's when things start to change for you. I understand because the ego is a very weird thing, you know. It's like people around you start to build you up and start to tell you what's right for you and what you should be doing and what you shouldn't be doing. And all that stuff, it starts to play on your own ego and stuff. And you realize, you know, you start to think differently. My thing is, I'm like, you don't know until you get in the room. And you don't know, like, what their vision of the character is and how they want to do this thing. So I think that comes into play because people sometimes get these offers and they get these things where people are like, you know, it's an offer only situation. They go in and something doesn't click right. Maybe they don't like the director, or maybe they don't like the vision of the character. Then you get on the set and all of a sudden it's like it's not clicking.
Yeah, that's a great example of how your own ego can get in the way of like an audition can be just as important for you to audition the director or audition the material.
Yeah,
right?
To see what he's thinking and what is, how does he respond to what your vision is,
right.
You know? And also sometimes for your own self, it's like a workout. You know, at no point does any violinist or any other artist stop doing what it takes to them to get to where they are.
Right.
You're a singer, you have to sing. You can't just like stop singing for a year and then go and sing without
and show up on stage.
You know, you can't just stop anything and expect the instrument to still be in the same condition. So for actors, you know, unless you're doing theater all the time, which a lot of actors do, unless you're like still training with a coach or still going and doing classes, which a lot of actors don't, that audition time that's your workout. That's when you get to prepare for something that is actually just keeping you sharp. That's it. And so don't let it play on your ego. It's not about going in, oh, I didn't get the audition, or going in and still proving something to people that you shouldn't have to prove something to. No, it's a workout. I don't look at it as I'm going in there trying to prove something. I'm just going in and working out. And then that's it. That's all you're doing, you know?
Yeah, and that speaks to something that you can control versus I'm going to go in and hopefully they'll like me.
Yeah, I always look at the audition as a way of kind of saying, you know what, this is what I can do. This is what I can give you. If you like it, great. If not, you know, it's great. Good luck. Have a nice day. But what I'm bringing to them is my version of what I think this character can do. It was as if we were coming to shoot. You know, I'm not thinking about it like
it's a miniature version.
It's
of
a
the
miniature
movie.
Version of the film. You know, this is what I'm trying to give you. You know, without the set pieces, without the other actors. I mean, but it is a performance, so you should take it seriously, and you should approach it the same way you approach a live performance, and you approach it the same way you approach the day you shoot. You're trying to give them the version. You know, so the more time you put into the preparation, the more free you can become, because ultimately, the director is going to probably throw something at you just for shits and giggles. Just want to see if you can take a direction.
Right.
But be ready for that. You know, this is a chance where he wants to see how you work. You know, it might just be a test. He may not even have a clue. He might not have a clue what he wants to do with it. He may love what you did. Or maybe he might go, wow, never thought about it that way. That's always a possibility, too.
Right.
Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it doesn't. But yeah, you know, you got to be clear about your vision.
I'm sure the worst feeling in an audition is not to commit one way or the other, right?
Oh, but that's what they call bad acting. You know, and it has nothing to do with your abilities whatsoever. Bad acting is when you don't have a clear point of view. You know, because then it's just general, and then you don't. you don't get any experience from that person. And so you're trying to figure out what it is, why you feel nothing. And the person is because the person hasn't committed one way or the other. And right. So therefore you have a general sense of who this person is, but you don't really know. And the specificity in acting is what always gets people involved in characters, the specificity of it, because it makes them feel like they can relate to what they're going through because they too have felt that way. They can identify the emotional arc of the character. Whereas if they can't, then it's because the person hasn't convinced them or something. There's something there, but it's all about specificity. So you can't, you know, I think, you know, people, you can't just do that without putting some work in. And that's the funny thing about this business, you know?
Yeah, I did want to ask you before we moved on, you mentioned that it was probably because of your wife that that you didn't leave the business.
To complete that thought, my wife got a doctorate in comparative literature. And so she's a person who has a dramatic and artistic sensibility. And so she also could have been a critic. She also could have been a dramaturg. She has that kind of mind. Uh-huh. And so she's a very smart woman. She said, listen, I'm not going to lie to you. If I thought you sucked, if I thought you were no good, if I didn't see the potential, if I didn't think you could be big in this business, I would not tell you to continue to go on. I believe in you because I have a good eye. And I'm not going to lie to you, and because I kind of felt that, but I needed somebody who I felt trusted to also validate that. And it wasn't somebody that I didn't know was my wife. My wife had a good eye. I thought she kind of could tell.
That's what you want. That's what you want in a partner.
That's what you want. But here's a funny thing. If she didn't do that, I would have had to manifest some chip on my shoulder to continue to do it. There's a part of me that I think, you know, that says I would have walked away, but I don't know because all my life, I've either had someone encouraging me, or I've had to find someone to create this kind of, you know, like this sort of conflict, even through graduate school. Because in grad school, I didn't have it so easy. I mean, grad school, I got kicked around. I was on probation. I didn't take it seriously the first year.
Tell me more about that.
Well, you know, I was in grad school and I was young. I was 22 at the time. I was okay. The first, you know, I was the youngest in the class. So when I got in, it was a lot of work. It was a lot of work. And I didn't realize how much work. And so I was kind of immature. So I was a guy that, you know, when I got in there, I was like, you know, I was taking things lightly. You know, people wanted to go, you know, crack the books or kind of get work on their craft and get ready for the next day. You know, I wanted to go party. I wanted to go hang out and, you know, with the undergrads because I was 22. I wanted to go, you know, still have good time during the week. For me, what was happening, I was underachieving. See, when I got in class, I looked around and I thought to myself, and again, this is not ego, this is just me being matter of fact. I had a great time in undergrad. Undergrad was easy, you know, not easy, but like I had gotten validation, I had made progress, I was like, you know, the big kid on campus, I was getting all the roles, I was working with graduate students at the time.
You had some really positive
feedback,
reinforcement. Right.
Yeah. I think when you're a young actor, you know, you're born an actor, and then everything else is about making you, you know, maximize your skills and your powers. Like you have it. But sometimes you don't know how you did it. You don't know how to get back at it. So the ones that have this natural ability, they need somebody to sometimes guide them. That's what directors are for. That's what acting teachers are for. It's there. You know, some of the greatest actors of our time or of any generation were completely dysfunctional people.
Right.
Had a great potential to be actors. No potential to be normal human beings. Couldn't be good husbands. Couldn't be good fathers, good mothers. But they were great actors. Some of them are broken, and so they use that. You know, they had the technical method to tap right into that kind of stuff. You had a bad life. That was what they did. They exploited those moments. Meisner is like, you know, if you haven't had a bad life, we got to get you there somehow, so we got to use your imagination. And that's what I had an imagination, you know, since I was a kid. I played by myself. I didn't have a lot of friends, and I didn't need a lot of toys. I just go in a room and just kind of, you know, transport myself somewhere else. You know, that was my thing. So when I got in that class, I looked around, and I thought, well, I can do this, and I never really allowed them to. They wanted to break you down. That's what was hard for me. They wanted to get you to a place where you didn't have that confidence anymore, and they wanted to strip you of all of that. And
I didn't want to go through that work.
I didn't want anybody to peel back the layers and try to figure out what was underneath all this stuff. And it was very difficult to allow people to get into that. So
I wonder why you were so protective of that.
Well, you know what happened. My background is physically. You know, the first thing that my acting teacher said to me, Maggie Flanagan, who was, you know, a beast. She was, you know, and because of her, I got a second chance. And she gave me a second chance because she saw potential. First thing she said to me, you know, I wasn't the size I am now, but I was athletic. She said, "You look like you play football." I'm like, okay, you know, I don't. She was sizing me up, and what she was doing was trying to see how I would react to that, and to see. But see, that's the thing. The exterior, like as an actor, you got to be vulnerable. You got to find places to go, and you can't stop people from getting in there. You got to allow someone in there, and so you got to drop your guard. So I spent all my life, like most adults, building up this guard, you know, trying to make sure that nobody gets in and nobody hurts you. But that's the thing about actors. You got to let people hurt you. You got to let people get in and touch you and make you feel things that you don't want to feel. And so for the first year, most people were in that class were walking around crying all the time. They were, you know, mad. There were just emotions. That's all there was, emotions, just emotions. And I was like, this is ridiculous, you know?
Sounds like therapy.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was like, and I didn't understand it. I was like, what is this whole mess about? And I felt like
you,
it was—
You hadn't bought into that.
I didn't buy into it at first. And so the wallowing for wallowing's sake, I didn't get what the end result was going to be. Because that was what it was. They were trying to give me the tools. So then when they built you back up and they started doing scene work, you were emotionally available and you knew how to respond. You knew how to be in tune with your partner and to work up your partner and all this other stuff. So by the time I figured it out, I was almost through the first year. And it took between the first year and the second year for me to realize that I hadn't come this far to fail and that I couldn't allow my ego to get in the way of progress. And
so you said you were on probation. Do they almost like kick you out?
Yeah, they send you a letter and they tell you officially, listen, you know, this is where you are and this is what we're going to do. And if you don't get any better, we're going to kick you out. Artistic probation. There's lots of probation.
Artistic probation.
It was artistic probation, yeah. You could be on speech probation, voice probation. You could movement. They could put you on probation about anything. But the artistic was the big one because then if they're saying that you're not, as an artist, you're not progressing in the way we think you should.
Yeah, how do you deal with that? I mean, you had to kind of sit with that, right?
Oh, yeah. I had a whole summer to sit with that and kick in the gut. It was a soul-searching moment for me because now I had something to prove. You know, before, I could either fall or I could just, you know, meet the challenge head on. And so for me now, it was a challenge. It was like, I know I can do this. Not only can I do this, I'm way better than the people that are looking down their noses at me. And I really took that personal. Like for me, I started manifesting this me against the world kind of thing because I knew that people had kind of like passed judgment on me in the class and people were like in faculty members that kind of said, yeah, we know who this guy is. And that burned me up. That really.
Because you thought they don't know you.
They don't know me. And they had passed judgment based on the fact that they hadn't seen what I could do yet. And I also thought it was kind of, you know, I thought that they had kind of, the chips were stacked against me from the start. And so I started working and doing everything that I knew that I had to do. I wanted somebody to put me against the wall and say, we'll see if you can do it. And from that point on, it was about, you know, proving them wrong and proving myself right.
But, you know, getting back to one thing I have to stop you on is when you say this guy that came into the graduate program with ego and with armor and I just have to ask what you think made you, when you were younger, want to build that up.
It wasn't something I did intentionally. You know, I grew up, you know, in a very, you know, it's like macho. My dad was probably more emotionally and emotionally available and vulnerable than my mother, let's be quite honest. Not that he was a very, you know, tender guy by any stretch of the imagination, but my mother was very strong-willed and very mentally strong. And so she didn't, you know, she didn't express a lot of emotions. I remember distinctly talking to her, just to tell you what kind of person she is. I mean, she loves us, but she never really, like, she wasn't a huggy type, you know. I grew up, I was a very huggy type. I was a kid, I wanted to be right up on her.
You were the baby, right?
Yeah, I was holding, I was young as a four. I wanted to be on her arm. I wanted to be holding her around her waist. I was always around her, like, wanting to, you know, get closer to her, you know. And she was just like, you know, she loved me, but she wasn't that kind of, you know, cuddly mother. And I remember when before my dad passed away, you know, by that time I'd probably been, you know, when I'd come home and stuff, I'd hug my dad, you know. You know, I even got to the point where I, you know, hug him, give him a kiss on the cheek, that kind of thing. That we never did that growing up. You know, we weren't that expressive as a family. And my dad passed away. It was really painful. But I remember my mother. She cried. She you know, she had her moments. But she wasn't a ball of, you know, a blobbering mess that a lot of people, when you lose someone that you've been with for 44 years, she's a strong woman. And she keeps a stiff upper lip and she holds on. And I think that has always been something that kind of affected the way I grew up, you know, having this.
Where you had to be strong.
Had to be strong, you know, and it was no point in crying over spilt milk and just, you know, things, you know, that's life.
It's funny to be born as an actor, but then be in an environment where maybe you don't get to be as emotional as you are naturally.
Yeah, you want to let kids, I mean, I struggle with this. You want to let kids be kids. You want to let kids be expressive. You want to let them allow them to have that time to be kids. And I think, you know, like most people in society now, you want the kid to grow up as fast as possible. You know, stop doing this, behave, sit down, stop moving around, stop pretending this. You know, you want them to be act like an adult as soon as possible. And it's kind of, you know, if you want to be an actor, that's the worst thing. So I had to go against all of that and try to figure out how to get back to what made me special as a kid. You know, I knew I wanted to be an actress since I was like, you know, 8 years old. But her being that way kind of affected me. And so I had to figure out how to, like, get rid of it, how to get the scar tissue, to try to figure out how to get that part of you that is like a kid, you know?
I mean, I'm assuming that you matured pretty early.
Yeah.
And so how do you square being a childlike, imaginative kid who wants to be an actor with
being 6'3 and having a heavy voice?
And the first impressions that people have of that, and assuming, like, because what, you grew up in a small town, right?
Yeah.
People probably just assumed other things about you. Have you kind of dealt with that your whole life too?
Yeah, expectation. You know, I was 6'3 and I was probably 6'3 at, you know, when I got in high school, and I never grew much more after that, maybe 6'2. So I kind of just, I got tall quickly, and yeah, then I kind of stayed there. You know, I didn't want to be any taller. I would have been happy at 6'1. I got cousins who were taller, but I knew that for what I wanted to do, I didn't think height was necessarily going to be a big part of that. So, but expectation, you know, again, you know, I hate to generalize or stereotype, but I was expected to, everybody expected you to play sports or something, you know?
Right.
I'm like, I didn't want any parts of that. My first ambition I thought was, I think I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to, like, be a painter. You know, I was like, you know, probably before I wanted to be an actor, I wanted to be a painter. I was like 5 or 6. I was like, painting, that's what I wanted to do, paint. And then I quickly realized that painters didn't make money, and I didn't know any painters that were alive, and I just couldn't
figure out. I would assume in a tiny town, you probably wouldn't know any other actors either, right?
True, but I was really into encyclopedias. Like, we didn't have internet, but we had Encyclopedia Britannica and all that.
Yeah.
So I would go through the encyclopedia. I was going through A to Z, and that was me. Like, so I looked through the encyclopedia, because I don't know, my family would use them, like my brothers and sisters would go for research, but I like to look at them. I spent hours just sitting there just looking at that forever.
So you were self-taught in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I kind of, but it was all about things that I was interested in. The problem with school, for me, I was gifted, labeled gifted. But for me, I could not, maybe I had ADD, maybe I was just bored, but I felt like my life was going to lead me, the direction it was going to go in, I didn't need math and all stuff like that. So I was not a good student. I skipped classes, I was just doing enough to get by. And because I always kind of knew I was going to be an actor, and it didn't make sense. It doesn't. Looking back on, I wish I didn't do that. I was really one of those people that, you know, I show up to class, get a homeroom, and I'm out for like the rest of the day. Maybe, you know, I wouldn't do it every day, but I knew how many days. I was like Ferris Bueller. I mean, like, I had 10 days. I use them all. Use all my 10 days. It was something that I didn't take classes seriously. I loved. You know, I started a drama club. You know, for a couple of years in high school.
You did.
Did a couple plays, a few plays. That was what I did. I was hell-bent on being an actor, and I didn't think there was anything that could stop me. But I didn't take all the stuff, the typing. I didn't take all the things that you should learn in schools that are going to be great ways to have a day job. Because, you know, I wasn't thinking about that. I wasn't thinking about how I was going to provide for myself prior while I'm looking for an acting job.
Right.
I was just thinking about, well, I'm just going to be an actor. I mean, that's what's going to happen. So,
but it's so fascinating. You end up at you know, in a graduate program where you almost, that approach almost,
yeah,
makes you fail.
Yeah, it's because there's a certain academic approach to the work too. That's what I realized. I was very frustrating. Like, I could not, for the life of me, give you the formula. I would start the formula, and halfway through I would just go on my own way, and I'd find a way to get to it. But it wasn't a formula that I could rely on. So I had to find a way to kind of apply a formula to the work. The process for me, I'm like a musician who doesn't read music. You know, some of our greatest musicians of our time didn't read sheet music. Some of them who play, you know, play by ear. You hear the notes, you see the notes, you look at the scene, you know where the scene goes, you know where, and you start to play it out in your head. And the more you rehearse the scene, you play it on your head, then you start to, like, then you can change it, or you can, but you hear the notes. It's like a notes. You hear the notes, you see the notes, you see the turns, and so it's like music. And if you get it like that, I'm like, then no point in highlighting this and putting, well, this line is, this is what you're trying to do, this is your action. It becomes very tedious.
I think you were born with a healthy dose of confidence. And I think that, or you developed a healthy dose of confidence.
That's funny, because my wife says I'm the most insecure person she's ever met.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm a
glass half empty kind of guy. You ask anybody about me, oh my God.
But isn't that the irony of most actors, is that you have to have access to both sides, right?
You do. You're going to have enough people, enough things to happen in your life that you're probably going to be, you're gonna definitely have a chance to indulge on your pessimistic side and all that stuff like that. And so for me, again, you know, I'm always looking for a motivation. So, you know, I'll tell you, you know, when I grew up in South Carolina, I was talking to somebody about this, and we were laughing. A buddy of mine who's from New York, and we were laughing because I always had to manifest, again, sometimes a chip on my shoulder. Like, I had it in grad school, but up until then, I had all this encouragement. You know, white teachers in the South, where I was from, in South Carolina, one of the most reddest states I've ever, you know, of all time.
Sure.
Everybody there always said, you can do this. You can do whatever you want.
So you didn't have a natural thing to fight against.
Yeah, I had two parents. Didn't have a, you know, broken household. And I had teachers that encouraged me. It was the worst thing you could have as an actor because it makes you believe in yourself and could underachieve if you're not careful.
That's so interesting. And that's exactly what happened. You got to grad school and you didn't have enough to fight against.
Yeah, I didn't have enough to fight against. And then what was great and fortunate for the situation. So I looked at, like I said, I looked around. I realized that everybody else was getting this, you know, where ideally you get broken down.
Right.
So I was preparing myself for the real world and hardening after opening up to this idea that I need to break down to become more vulnerable and work as an actor. I was also using that as motivation and hardening myself, going, nobody believes in me. Nobody thinks that I can do this. I hold on to it now because that's what makes, you know, makes everybody.
That's your motivation.
Gotta motivate yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
You know, I mean, I could talk about this stuff forever because it's. I mean, I think the roots of where these things, where these habits and motivations, and you know, the beginnings of things are. It's fascinating to me to see where someone gets. Yeah. Whatever their formula is that makes things work.
Yeah.
But we should definitely jump forward to what's happening now. I mean, obviously you're in Luke Cage and you're in the middle of this Marvel world. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you about a soldier's play.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that I read that you said that this was a huge moment for you in your career.
When I saw this was a play that was being put up in New York, again, this was after Million Dollar Baby. I didn't know what I was going to do in my career because I knew I wasn't going to. People, you know, the idea was like, oh, you played a boxer, you'd be an athlete. And I was like, I don't want to be an athlete. I don't want to do anything that's going to rely on my physical. I need something else. I know I got more potential. I'm not the guy that stands there and says nothing. I'm not the guy that. So I had all these ideas about what I want to do and how I want to prove everybody for what I wanted, what I saw for myself. I didn't want to be defined by what they thought I could do. And so it changes all the time. I go, This time I want to do this. This time I want to do that.
So what you're saying is after Million Dollar Baby, there was a tendency to get typecast as an athlete.
And I sat there and did nothing.
A boxer.
Athlete of some sort. And I did nothing.
And as an artist, you don't want to repeat yourself.
No, I just want to find something else. And I argued with my agent at the time, and we argued about it, and he wanted to send me stuff, and we just couldn't see eye to eye. He didn't see my vision. And we just fought about it all the time. And so this part came up, and I was like, this is perfect. Except this guy plays a guitar, and I don't play guitar. And I was like, but I'm still going to get this role. Like, this is what I told my agent at the time. I was like, that's me. I can do this role. I understand this character. Get me in there. And they were looking for like weeks at a time.
Yeah.
So I go in there. Everybody's, you know, you got me the audition. Everybody's got a guitar in there, warming up, tuning up, all that stuff. And then I don't have a guitar. I don't have a guitar. I'm sitting in the waiting room. I'm just sitting there going, I just know that this part's for me. And I go in there. I do the audition for Joe Bonney. And she's like, I go in and it went pretty well. Got a call back. I knew that what I thought I could do for this role was going to be unique, and I thought I could really get this is going to be something that could change my career in a small way, but also in a very large way. So I go in, and the second time around, we go in again. I sing the pieces a cappella because I don't have a guitar. And she looks at me now and she says, I think you can do this part. Really, you know. Can you learn to play the guitar? I mean, we have to do this play in like 6 weeks. You know, this is 6 weeks, 7 weeks. You know, preview start. Can you do it? Do you have the dexterity in your fingers? Like, are you a musician? Do you have like? Is anybody in your family play? Ask me all these questions. I'm like, you know, I'm like, well, my brother plays. He was a drum major. You know, musicality runs the family. My nephew plays a good piano. I'm like, we have a piano in the house. Growing up, I didn't play it, but I just had to. But there was no part of me that thought I couldn't do it. So I get the role. And I immediately, you know, by the time, I think she calls me and tells me I got the role, I go out immediately, I'm on Craigslist and I find guitars. I go to the guitar store and I get the picks and I start looking at YouTube videos and I'm doing what I can do. Now they hire a guy named Steve Barganetti because he's a Juilliard trained guitarist and I've stayed in touch with him over the years because he was instrumental in getting me to help to get pull this role off. And Steve Barganetti's, he comes in and he realizes I got a lot of work to do. I don't play guitar and I sang in concert choir when I was an undergrad, but this is completely different. This is blues.
Yeah.
This is an expression of emotion. This is something that's not classical. It's just something you do. And it's like, it's not about form as much as about expression. And the playing of the guitar and singing at the same time, it has to look effortless and it has to look like you've been doing your whole life.
Yeah.
So we had to start from zero, and my fingers, I got to get the calluses on my finger because I'm playing every day and I'm working at it. I show up to rehearsals the first day to table read, got the guitar. I got nothing to do. I can't play at all. People are looking like, oh my God,
we're in trouble.
I'm in trouble. Everybody's thinking about themselves in a collective way, but mostly they're thinking about me. I'm going, this guy is going to be in trouble. I mean, I'm not kidding you. I'm sure that everybody was nervous, but nobody was more nervous than me. I think I could have destroyed my career, honestly. I think I could have destroyed my career in that one swoop, because in New York City, with all the cast and directors and people coming to see these kind of plays, and if I sucked, if it just didn't work, I don't know if I could have recovered from that.
And think about that. You'd come off one of the biggest movies of the year. Mm-hmm. The Million Dollar Baby won.
Yeah, and I knew that. When I read it, I was like, I told my agent, this is going to win the Oscar.
You do that, and again, your physicality mm-hmm. gets sort of in the way of the first impression thing.
It's a limiting thing. Everybody thinks,
everyone thinks that's the guy you get.
Yeah,
but
I didn't. I never boxed, so I had to go then lie about that and go start boxing. So I had to start doing that too. And again, I was happy that I did that, but then I was like, I'm playing into this part. I don't want people to realize I'm not that guy.
But it's so amazingly brave to, after that, like, throw yourself into this thing where you're playing guitar, like the exact opposite. Like,
I was scared shitless.
I mean, that's the definition of an artist, right? Someone who's just going to take a left turn right when things are lined up for him.
Yeah, that's kind of what, I mean, I think it's going to, you know, I don't know. There's always, because at some point, you know, after Million Dollar Baby, I didn't capitalize on anything. I was really in a rut because I didn't want to do what everybody wanted me to do. And it was like, I didn't realize that how opportunities don't always come around. And so I was always thinking that. So when this opportunity came along, this was like, I mean, I couldn't have thought of a better time to try something like this. But at the same time, it was so, and I wasn't getting paid any money. It was off Broadway, but I knew that this was going to change how people saw me. And so when I got in and I did the play, I got to tell you, man, I was so scared. I was getting heat from my cast members. I come in a couple hours before, a couple hours after, at home, I'm wearing my wife out, singing, make horrible noises with the guitar. It is sucking for a long time. It was very scary. So, and just to know that every night I was going to be live, like, it was just going to be a different level of you know, risk. And when it came together, man, I got to tell you, it was like jumping off a cliff every night. And I think everybody was always in shock that it worked. It was the scariest thing I've ever done. And after that, I was like, I can do anything. Because once I got through it, I mean, you know, knock on wood, the reviews, I never read reviews, but there was one review that I read because my wife said, you got to read this one. This is, you know, New York Times. It's kind of the one that counts. And this is the one that's, you know, singing your praises. And Ben Brantley, he, you know, said I was great. You know, said I was a fine of the production. And so those words, I said to myself, I said, mission accomplished. I mean, I just felt like, as scary as it was, if I didn't do well, I don't think I would have gotten anywhere else, because those doors that opened for me in casting offices in New York City would not have opened for me.
Well, what an amazing example of not doing the thing that is going to be safe. To get something like Million Dollar Baby and then get offers of work and still turn it down and try to do something
different.
I
wouldn't even go in, you know, I wouldn't even go in for things. I would just like completely, I was completely adverse. The idea of me doing something that I felt like I'd already done before and that somebody was kind of assuming that was going to be my wheelhouse offended me. It offended me and it still offends me. Like right now, I mean, I got a chip on my shoulder now. It's always like every time I do something, if it comes out, you know, reasonably well, I'm like finding out what else is there to be mad about so that I can try and figure something else to go on. Because, I mean, that's what happens, you know. I'm thinking, you know, because when I did that, I remember going into a manager's office after he had seen me in New York, and he had introduced me to his other partner, who was the younger version, who was going to do a lot of stuff. And his partner said something that offended me again. He hadn't seen the play, but he said, or he'd heard about the play or something like that, and he said, well, you know, I mean, it's a country boy, you know, and you know, he's from the South, and you know, and you know, it's a good thing, but it's kind of a period piece. And I mean, well, you know, I mean, they're not making those kind of, you know, TV shows, or, you know, I don't know anything about that kind of stuff. Like that's not what they're casting for right now.
In other words, that's all you could do.
Yeah, and I, it, First of all, when he said that, I was like, I knew right then I wasn't going to sign with those guys. That was number one. And it wasn't the guy who brought me in. But because he had a person like that working for him, I was like, never. And I sat there and I watched his client list for the next 5 years, and I judged them, and I was out to make sure that every time he looked around that I was going to be doing something that he couldn't ignore, and that he was going to wish that he didn't say those words to me. He's going to wish that he signed me, and he's going to wish that he had bent over backwards, because they were saying, well, we want you to move to LA and we can get you out. And I said, well, I'm in New York right now. This is my life. And if you want to work with me, you got to do it now. And I'll come out to LA later, but I need you to help me now. And they were like, I don't know, we can take a risk. And I'm like, you know, it's your loss. And so every time I was like, you know, I was thinking about those guys. I thought about what he said to me. I was like, you think that's all I can do? Like, that's great. But you think that's what? I was like, I'm an actor. And I said, it's offensive. It was so offensive. I was like, you guys are crazy.
And funny enough, that was the thing that was so hard for you to do, that was so different from Million Dollar Baby.
Yeah, that was,
and then
like,
you get judged for, I mean, that's a window into the mindset of the idea that you put someone in their lane and you keep them there, you put them in a box, and this actor does this.
If you do it well, I'm like, you know, it's almost like a catch 22. It's like, if you do it too well, that they think, well, that's you know, that's kind of who he is, right?
So this is a great way to transition to Luke Cage, because I would assume that when you originally get the call to mm-hmm. do Luke Cage, there's that same physicality expectation or
yeah.
stereotype thing that comes up.
Yeah.
And you probably had trepidation. When you were originally offered that, was that something you jumped at or something that you worried about?
Oh, I was so against it. I was like, I mean, honestly, I mean, when I revisit the feeling I had at the first initial looking at the character, trying to figure out, researching the character of who this guy is, I'm like, I don't want any parts of this. I couldn't think of anything that I didn't want to do more. I didn't want to do anything physical, a physical role where that it relied on power and all that stuff like that. And also just, I didn't know how the character would be written. I didn't know what this character was going to be like. So I was like, you know, it just seemed limiting. I just thought, you know, what can I do with this? And I hadn't seen any material yet. I just thought the idea of the character made me cringe, because I was very concerned about, you know, because everybody has an idea how the character is going to be. And I was like, well, this is, you know, if I'm going to do this, this is how I'm going to do it. And, you know, this is it. Take it or leave it. Now, I mean, not saying that's what I said, but I felt like if they were to try to push me in a certain way, then I would have walked away from it, because I didn't, it's only one way that I thought this character should be portrayed that I wasn't going to compromise on. If I had to compromise on his essence, then I guess I got to go another
way. So that
direction.
Was your criteria for the role?
I think there's an essence to this character.
I see it one way. And
it has to be this way. I mean, I had a job at the time. It wasn't something that was going to be foolproof. I knew it was going to be going for years, but I had a job. I was playing a guy on a show that was, you know, he was a politician of sorts, and, you know, more of my lane, you know. I like guys who talk and have a lot going on. I'm a thinker, and I'm a person that, you know, I believe that the characters I play, you know, have a lot to offer. And so I wanted to be in a position where I was playing characters like the greatest role I ever played. I did a pilot. I remember I was playing an epidemiologist, and I was like, you know, I would love that job. It was like the best job. I mean, the creator had to fight for me to get that job. I mean, he went through months of like studio saying, no. First of all, you couldn't be black. And then, okay, if you're gonna go black, you gotta go somebody else. And all of that. It was ridiculous. But in my mind, I knew, like, I'm like, I'm the only person that's going to be able to do this role right, white or black. And if you don't like it, then fine. But I had no problem when he told me a couple times, like he called me, he said, it doesn't look like it's going to happen. He was so hurt. And I was like, don't worry about it. It's okay. You tried. It's okay. Don't worry about it, because I know what I did. And I know what you, it's fine. It's fine. Good luck. You know, that kind of stuff. And it worked out. I got the pilot and get picked up. And, you know, that's the end of the story. But that's the kind of stuff. I'm like, epidemiologist. Yeah. Doctor. Yeah. That's me. Let me do that. But my exterior doesn't, that's not what people see. So
yeah.
This was like, when I saw this role, and I was like, no, you know?
You know, I feel like we're talking around it a little bit, but what I hear you saying is that you've been sort of, you know, the victim of stereotyping.
Yeah.
And I think all actors go through this, mm-hmm. but to have the exterior that you have and sort of have the, you know, a few of your bigger roles being a certain thing,
uh-huh.
you've really had to deal with that and more than probably a lot of actors have to not only change someone's perceptions, but even put it on the table that you could be something else. I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about here.
Yeah,
right?
Always, you know, because there's only so many roles that are available. So, I mean, you know, it's always like it's more people, more actors than jobs. I was always proud of myself on avoiding the obvious.
It's funny, when you talk about that, I realized for the first time that that there's a very strong parallel between sort of what you've dealt with in the business and this character. Like, yeah. When you get down to it, I read something where you said when you took this role, you sat down in front of a mirror and you tried to find a reluctant hero or a vulnerable hero in the mirror. And it made me think a different way about the work actors have to do sometimes, like the silent work that's not about the text. Is that moment when you're sitting in front of a mirror, is the idea that you're going to have to believe yourself as that person before an audience member can?
Yeah, that's why, you know, I started going to gym immediately. I need to find the physicality. I need to feel like it. You know, part of anything is kind of believing, you know, in yourself. I mean, there's a lot of people like, you know, listen, I'm a big Al Pacino fan. I don't think anybody, you know, thinks of Al Pacino. I mean, they think of him as a tough guy, but he's not big in stature. So when you watch him on film, and you watch him, you know, in a Scarface, which is one of those classic films that people, you know, revere today, and it's one of my favorite films. I watch it 1,000 times. He's just got this moxie, this thing that, well, you know, whatever. He's five, whatever. But he could take you out. You know, you feel like he could take you out. Not because he's, you know, got the size, but because he believes it, and therefore you believe it.
Yeah, how does he do that?
How does he make you fear him? And you watch him, he's the smallest guy on screen. How does he make you do that? So when you have that, I mean, this character, I look at him on page, I'm going, I gotta start taking steroids. I mean, this guy is, you know, that's what this guy is. He's a freak of nature.
Right.
But I said, I'm not gonna do that, honestly, obviously. But what essence of this guy is going to make me feel like I could be this guy and make the audience believe that I could be this guy? How do we come to this character that comes across as this guy that's, you know, stronger than everybody else, unbreakable skin, all this other stuff that you know, that I'm not going to do, you know, freak of nature steroids to get to? And because it's not about that, you know, so that's how the work begins. You know, you start looking at it from that standpoint and trying to figure out how do you convince yourself, and how do you feel? And this was hard because this is the last thing I wanted to do. I didn't want to be in the situation where I was creating this character. But what was appealing to me about this character is that, you know, I was tasked with something that if I did it correctly, it wouldn't be a cliche.
You know, I don't know. This is crazy, but I hear you talking, and I go, well, it's not that different from talking to a woman who's got, you know, has such a hard time finding a great role.
Yeah, I mean, because if you're a hot woman with a nice body, I mean, what do you got to do to find a role that doesn't rely on you getting naked to, you know, like...
You're a hot woman with a nice body.
Yeah, you know, but that's kind of what you are. Like, they see you, they have an idea.
They see your exterior.
They want to capitalize on what you naturally have. Why would they want to put you in a muumuu, cover that all up, you know, take your highlights out, get you ugly. You know, like, you know, one of the greatest performances I'd ever seen and kind of, you know, got me, you know, as an actor, sometimes like there are performances that inspire me. You know, one of the performances that inspire me, you know, like, you know, Charlize Theron back when I was Monster.
On Monster.
You go, why would someone want to do that? Because that is what acting is. And this is what inspires us. I mean, she's a model. She, you know, physically, this is what people see. Beautiful, certain look, tall, you know. And she goes and tries to put as much weight as she can on and get as ugly as she can to come to make you not see her as that this woman, so she can play this other role that is actually giving her something to sink her teeth into.
Right.
And so that's what actors are trying to do, because, you know, our obstacle is the people who are casting, the people who are, you know, creating the jobs, because they're not once do they really think about us as actors. They're not thinking that's why the problem is. I mean, we have the one art form that nobody actually respects. Of all the art forms, you know, violinist, no one sees a person playing a violin and goes, I can do that. No one sees a dancer, ballerina, doing her, you know, pirouettes, you know, jumping through the air, looking like, you know, effortlessly, the length of the leg, the extension, the flexibility. No one says, I can do that, jumping out of bed. I'm like, I can do that. No one does it to any other, you know, discipline except acting, because it looks like we're doing nothing. And doesn't matter, you know, when it's done well, it looks like you're just living life. And so we'll always have people who are trying to get into it because it sounds like something they can approach.
Right.
And because the producers are allowing them to approach it, it's like, well, because they think they can, you know, with the cameras, you know, there's all these tricks. Well, we'll just keep giving them another take. We'll shoot at this angle. We'll get the director in there. Or we'll give them the right role that is kind of like who they are, but, you know, and maybe they'll have success. Well, listen, if you were born and you were on drugs and you're a crack addict, if you get a good director and get a good writer, maybe they can actually get a good performance out of you.
Maybe once.
Once. but that doesn't make you an actor. And so then the rest of their life, they're going, oh, I'm an actor now. No, you're not. No, you're not. You're just a person that they propped up, they put in a certain position, they made you look good, with the light just right, right costume. You got away with it.
You're See, not in a way, an actor. In a way, Luke Cage is probably the ultimate challenge for you as an actor, because you already sort of are that guy, and that's how people saw you, and yet your challenge is to make that more than what people can see.
Yeah, the exterior.
Even more than the epidemiologist. Like,
who's the smartest guy in the room at all times. It was just like, yeah, it was just, you know, that's the kind of stuff that gets me going, you know.
But I think the reason I was drawn to the show is because you've managed to humanize him, and I think that you're right. I think people think when they watch great acting that it's just that all the elements were in place. Well, they put the right guy in the right costume under the right light.
Yeah, and they can do that to me.
A magic trick takes place.
Yeah, it's something, you know, I mean, and sometimes...
That must be frustrating. And it must be frustrating that often becomes the storyline rather than what's really happening.
Yeah, I've gotten over it. I think I've grown enough in this business to know that that's not what I'm there for, to resist this thing that's going to happen in show business regardless of whether I wanted to or not. You know, producers pulling people off the street, you know, whatever, getting people who are like, well, you know, they got a lot of followers on Twitter or something like that. Let me put them in. It's like, God, it kills me. It kills me. But this is the world I'm in. I can't judge them anymore because this is beyond my control. I can only work on my craft and then we'll see what happens. I think the great thing about acting is, like, you know, the truth is in the work and in the material, and so I hope to always have someplace else to go. So, I mean, when I look at my work, I'm just beginning. I mean, I don't think I've done, you know, I've never really thought of myself as having a career yet. I still feel like I'm just starting, and so, you know, I feel like there's so many places to go, so many different parts, and, you know, parts that people will say, don't do that role, don't try this role, you know. I did this silly independent film that, you know, just found its way on iTunes, and I'm like, I did it a couple years ago, and it was a labor of love for me, and I was just attracted to the role, and it was for no money, and I remember going, I was like, I like this role, I want to do this role. And everybody's like, what do you want to do this role for? I'm like, because it's kind of strange, and it's interesting, and it's just weird. And I wish
That's why you become an actor,
yeah,
right? Because you want to...
Try something that, if it scares you sometimes, then it's probably, that's probably a good thing. And I think if it doesn't scare you, then probably maybe, I'm not saying it's not right for you, but that's when you should really look at it. And it's, I don't know how to put my finger on it, but I think when you're scaring you, you know that you're taking a risk, and somebody's taking a chance on you. I think that's the two things, you know. So with like Luke Cage, I mean, I still think, you know, sometimes I look at it and I go, you know, is I think it's been well received, but I look at it as, you know, and now I gotta prove everybody something else. Now I gotta, you know, here we go again, you know. Now everybody's thinking, oh, well, you know, that's, we know who he is. No, you don't. You have no clue.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you for opening up and sharing this stuff.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me there.
Hey, folks, that's our show today. Thanks for listening. And before we tell you about next week's guest, I just want to take a minute and thank you all for tuning in to Off Camera. We are having a great season, and with every one of these conversations I have, I feel like the luckiest person in the world, because I get to sit in this chair and have these conversations with these amazing artists, and I learn something new every time we do it. And I hope you do too. And listen, if you have any comments, criticisms, suggestions, ideas, you just want to drop me a line and say hi, please do. My email address is sam@offcamera.com, and I would love to hear from you. And if you love the show, please don't keep it a secret. Tell all your friends about Off Camera so we can keep bringing you these conversations. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor, producer, and author Rob Lowe.
People just come into this world who they are. I just wanted to act. I knew at 8. I mean, I had a whole career of ups and downs and network deals and movies I read for and all of it before I was 17.
While his ridiculous good looks threatened to become a stigma, his career longevity has much more to do with his sharp sense of humor and a fearless, original approach to any project he takes on. If you don't believe me, go watch Behind the Candelabra. See you next time, Off Camera.